I'm pleased to have an opportunity to share with you some thoughts about what we've been doing out here, what we've been learning as we travel across this great nation, conducting Farm Bill forums. The concerns and ideas shared by farmers and ranchers, I will tell you also, are having a tremendous influence on my view of farm policy. We've seen it really up close. I would also be remiss if I just didn't take a moment to extend my gratitude to farmers and ranchers and other stakeholders by the hundreds who have traveled many miles and in some cases even waited for hours for the opportunity to speak. We've been turning out great crowds, as you know. Their comments are certainly having an impact. As of today, USDA has conducted 26 forums, 26 states. I've personally hosted forums in 17 states, which translates into 51 hours of listening intently to farmers, ranchers, and to other stakeholders. As our listening tour continues, I am confident I'll hear more insightful ideas, no doubt about it. But today I am here to offer some observations about what I have heard thus far. There is significant debate occurring across this country when it comes to the 2007 Farm Bill. I'll be honest. I was very uncertain as to what I would hear when I kicked off this nationwide listening tour now about 3 months ago. I knew only that the president and I felt very, very strongly that it was vitally important that we listen to those affected by farm policy and to give them a say in the development of new policy. Today I can report to you that I've heard some very strong opinions expressed by some very, very passionate people. These thoughtful comments have caused me to step back and to think about the boundaries of our current farm policy. What I will share with you today are our impressions, not the result of a formal analysis of the feedback that we have received. My thoughts today should not be considered an outline of farm policy for the next farm bill. They are impressions of what I am hearing. Farm bills are written in Congress, signed in the White House. I myself am really months away from specific proposals. But this gathering does give me an opportunity to share my thoughts with those of you who represent so many of our nation's producers. As I summarize the ideas and concerns that I have heard, my hope is that we can work together, that we can work together to meet the challenges that are ahead of us. I begin by sharing with you that I am so very impressed with the thoughtful consideration that producers are obviously giving as they prepare their comments and deliver them. In fact, I'm especially impressed by their very honest and frank assessments of the benefits and the drawbacks of current farm policy. Now, as of today, I can safely say that we're seeing some patterns in the responses. There seems to be a consensus among producers and other stakeholders on some policies that's pretty clear, and then a very definite diversity of opinion relative to other policies. We have heard almost unanimous support for our rural development programs. In fact, I'm not stretching it to say that as of today, not a single negative comment in any Farm Bill forum that I've done. Our contributions to everything from water systems to hospitals are appreciated. There's visible evidence. People can see we're making a difference out there. President Bush's leadership in rural development is clearly a difference maker in the lives of rural residents, and they appreciate it. We have also heard tremendous support for another of the president's priorities, and that is conservation. The president's cooperative conservation programs provide farmers and ranchers with financial support, but they also benefit the whole of society by protecting our natural resources today and for future generations. We've heard a lot about competitiveness and opening doors to new and expanded markets for U.S. ag products. Trade always gets a debate. Farmers and ranchers believe in trade, but they believe it must be fair trade. And I share that view. Producers understand that more than one quarter of farm cash receipts come from trade. It's an important part of their bottom line. On the other hand, we are hearing a range of opinions when it comes to farm support programs. Some predicted that all we would hear is a desire for more of the same. We have heard that, but clearly we have also heard from producers who are advocating for change. Now, I will tell you what I think many of you know already, those of you who are veterans of previous farm policy debates, and that is that the responses also vary by region of the country and by program. For example, in the Midwest, many are urging stronger payment limits. Farmers will get right up to the microphone and tell us that. Yet in the South, there's opposition to that idea, strong opposition. In Texas yesterday, there was strong support for the 2002 Farm Bill. Yet low prices throughout much of this Farm Bill troubled farmers there. And I hear farmers coming to my office talking about the local elevator quoting near $1.30 corn. On a broader scale, concerns have been expressed about farm payments being capitalized into increased land values, farm program support being directed toward one-third of all producers, and the greatest benefits going to the largest farms. As I have said before, I believe the 2002 Farm Bill was the right policy for the economic conditions at the time. But I also recognize that times change. Soon, very soon, we must decide as a nation whether to embrace a new age of agriculture or continue relying on a policy structure that was literally conceived 75 years ago when the face of agriculture was very different than it is today. I've heard some very compelling stories from young people who grew up on farms and want to carry on the wonderful tradition of farming, but are financially unable to do so because of high land values and cash rent. We'll put those up on the slide there. Devin from Kentucky says this. He says, one of the biggest barriers, I believe, facing the new generation of farmers is the inability to start farming from scratch. Today, if anyone wanted to begin farming, they either have to marry into a family farm or inherit an existing family-owned farm. It is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to simply start farming. Dan in California had this to say, the increasingly high investment costs and relatively low return rates associated with production agriculture are some of the most prominent unintended consequences that discourage future generations from entering production agriculture. Many have echoed those remarks and raised the issue that when farm support programs are tied to production, they translate into more land being acquired to continually produce more crops in an effort to gain more support. When farm policy encourages farms to become bigger and produce more, regardless of market demand, we should not be surprised when prices for our commodities are low. Keith in Illinois said this. I thought it was pretty profound. He said, cheap corn prices destroy our schools, churches, and drive people to the city for a job that may or may not be there. The 96 and 2002 Farm Bills did not reduce production as was needed. It reduced producers. Codename, farmers. It was disheartening to hear some farmers who have worked the land all of their lives to predict a future for our children and grandchildren when those who work the land cannot afford to own the land. Which leads directly into another message I am consistently hearing. Small and minority farmers are expressing frustration about the lion's share of federal farm support being focused on very large operations. Alfonso in New Mexico had this to say. He said, we need to have some kind of clause in our bill that does not give all the money that's appropriated to the farmers, to big corporate farms, and to our part-timers. In Oklahoma, a woman by the name of Hope said, the biggest farmers out there should not be encouraged to continue getting bigger and bigger, while normal medium-sized farm operations cannot afford to even expand in the smallest way because of high land prices. That's certainly not the first time I've heard these concerns expressed, so I felt the best way to approach this was to turn to the actual data. And at the USDA, we have data. So that brings me to my next slide. For the purpose of this illustration, large farms consist of those reporting more than $500,000 in sales. Medium-sized farms are those reporting more than $250,000 in sales. The red bars on that graph represent percent of payments, and the blue bars represent percent of farms. As you can see, the largest 3% of farms receive nearly 30% of payments. If we put the medium and large farms together, we're talking about less than 8% of all farms receiving 50% of government payments. Now, I would suggest that this brings some clarity to the picture being painted by beginning farmers, as well as small and minority farmers that we're hearing from across the country. Another message I've heard is one of discontentment with the fact that some crops are offered more protection than others by our programs, our support programs. David in Wisconsin said, I grow vegetables for processing and I rent a large portion of my land. Landlords are reluctant to rent land to process vegetable growers because it will hurt their base calculations in the future. Andy in Illinois said, the facts are, the 2002 Farm Bill placed restrictions on farmers who plant fruits and vegetables. The next Farm Bill should allow farmers the flexibility they need to choose the crops they grow, specifically in planting fruits and vegetables. This change would correct the unforeseen consequences or problems that occurred in the 2002 Farm Bill that discouraged producers from diversifying their farming operations. Like I said, we're hearing strong opinions out there. This listening tour really highlighted for me the level of debate across the country about the disparities in program support amongst commodities. So again, I turned to the USDA and I asked for data relating to the distribution of support payments, and this is what the facts show. This is what they illustrate, and that's slide number 9. Clearly, we do not have uniformity in the level of support offered by current farm policy. The red bar represents crop program spending, and the blue bar represents production value. In fiscal year 2005, we spent an estimated $15.2 billion on program crops and less than one-half of $1 billion on all other commodities covered by price and income support programs. Program crops represent a quarter of production value, yet they receive virtually all of the funding. Let me state that another way. 92% of commodity program spending was paid on 5 program crops: corn, wheat, soybeans, cotton, and rice. The farmers who raise other crops, and that's actually 2/3 of all farmers, receive really little support from current farm programs. And yet, as I travel the country, I have not been hearing those 2/3 of farmers, fruit and vegetable farmers and others, ask for program support. Instead, they are looking to the future and they are asking for more focus on such things as research and promotion, increased sanitary and phytosanitary enforcement, and access to new markets. Ladies and gentlemen, as I hear farmers question the fairness of support programs from one crop to the next, a similar discussion is taking place internationally, as you know, from one country to the next country. The WTO's decision against our Step 2 program for cotton shook the very confidence many felt in the ability of current farm policy to provide a true safety net. Add to that the potential challenge to our rice program, and of course we've all read about Canada's investigation into our corn program, and you can understand why I describe the current farm bill as perhaps, the most high-risk approach we could take for our nation's farmers and ranchers as we think about the future. Now, it occurs to me that we have a choice. It is a choice. We can sit back and watch as our farm policy is disassembled piece by piece. Or we can begin a discussion about how to craft farm policy that provides a low-risk, meaningful safety net for our farmers and for our ranchers. I would suggest to you we must choose wisely, remembering that more than a quarter of our farm cash receipts come from trade. It cannot be ignored. Additionally, 95% of the world's population doesn't live here. They live outside the United States. With agricultural productivity far outpacing consumption in this country today, we cannot afford to turn our backs on world trade standards. If we do indeed want to firmly control the shape of future U.S. farm policy, which I certainly believe we do, then I would suggest to you we must be bold. We must use the WTO to force open markets for U.S. products. Now, let me be very, very clear. The WTO will not write our next farm bill. But we must show leadership in the area of support program policy to gain market access in other countries. There are choices. If we timidly take our seat at the world trade table with a farm program structure that is wed to the past, we can expect a future of playing defense to protect our share of trade and wondering which U.S. farm program might be challenged next. On the other hand, if we boldly take our seat at the world trade table, then we'll have the opportunity to control the future of U.S. farm policy instead of having that future dictated to us. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind that we can show tremendous support of agriculture without trade distorting subsidies. Let me repeat that because I believe that's important. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind that we can show tremendous support of agriculture without trade-distorting subsidies. I am confident that America's farmers and ranchers can compete with any farmer or rancher in the world if given a fair opportunity. Ladies and gentlemen, we have the chance to provide that opportunity, and I would suggest to you we can't afford to let it slip away. Some have expressed concern about giving up what is considered to be the current safety net. So if I might just ask you to contemplate the purpose of a safety net and whether current farm programs truly fulfill that purpose for all of American agriculture. Consider the concerns our producers have raised that we quoted, the WTO cotton case and other program challenges, the inability of young people to enter agriculture, government payments capitalizing into higher land value and raising cash rent. Large farms getting the lion's share of payments, and two-thirds of farmers being provided really little protection in our farm programs. Now, I put the question to you, is that the best we can do? Certainly it is not. We must become more inclusive and effective in the delivery of our support to our farmers and ranchers. I have long argued that investing in agriculture is a very smart choice for America. And today I feel more strongly than ever about the importance of that investment. Agriculture is the heartbeat of America. Our farmers and ranchers fulfill the most basic human need by providing the safest and most abundant food supply in the world. It is not an overstatement to say that our producers play a vital role in providing our country with the security we need to be leaders of the free world. We must recognize that the contribution and demonstrate our support for those who are willing to work the long hours in the fields and ranches of America. But we must also ask ourselves how we provide that support in a way that is sustainable over time. How do we build into farm policy a future for smaller farmers and those who want to enter farming? How do we build in support for our rural communities? How do we build in support for $62 billion worth of U.S. exports? Well, I believe we do so by fighting for America's farmers and ranchers. A true safety net for all of agriculture is so much more than subsidies. It is good farm policy that opens real and substantial market access. A true safety net is also good tax policy, trade policy, sanitary and phytosanitary policies and enforcement and investment in new markets. I believe in providing a safety net for farmers and ranchers, but it must be inclusive, it must be predictable, and it must be beyond challenge. Now, I would suggest to you that the easy choice is simply to repackage. Repackage the current farm policy and convince ourselves that the old structure of payments based on production levels will somehow provide adequate support. We could choose to ignore the challenges to that old structure, but doing so would be the same as saying that it's rather okay to jeopardize a quarter of our cash receipts and ignore the current program imbalances. Farmers may disagree on approaches. We always have. But there is a common desire for a predictable future. We in Washington, I believe, have an obligation to listen and then to respond. I don't believe the easy road is going to lead us there on this one. I would suggest to you that we have to think about, we must chart a new course for American agriculture. We must develop policy that delivers sensible support to agriculture in a way that can't be challenged. We need only to listen to the ideas of those we serve and to recognize that there is a reason we have heard unanimous support for our rural development programs and encouragement to enhance our conservation programs and to expand market access. There is tremendous wisdom being relayed to us by those beyond the Beltway, and I am listening. I don't yet know how these ideas should best come together to form future farm policy. As I said at the start of my comments, specific proposals months away. But I welcome the opportunity to work with Congress and you to fashion a farm bill that demonstrates a true commitment to our farmers and ranchers, policy that does not put support programs at risk. Now, I know I don't stand alone. I have talked with leaders in the House and the Senate, and their commitment to rural America is equally strong. They, too, will travel this country to hear firsthand the wisdom being shared, and we will work together to infuse that wisdom into farm policy. in closing, I return to the time and place where this venture began now some months ago. I announced USDA's nationwide listening tour at the state FFA convention in Illinois. I have a special fondness because I was an FFA member myself. I spoke to young people who have hopes and dreams of carrying on the great tradition of American agriculture. I was reminded of my days as a member of the FFA while growing up on that dairy farm in Iowa. In fact, I was reminded of the power of the FFA pledge. I even repeated it in my comments to the FFA. I would do so here today. I think it's very relevant. The FFA pledge says, I believe in the future of agriculture with a faith born not of words but of deeds. Achievements won by the present and past generation of agriculturalists in the promise of better days through better ways, even as the better things we now enjoy have come to us from the struggles of former years. 40-plus years ago, ladies and gentlemen, when I first recited that pledge, I saw a real future in agriculture, and I still do today, fully aware that agriculture is changing. Our family farm of 30 cows, some chickens, cattle, a dozen sows, it's a rarity today. But belief in the future of agriculture is not. We do have a choice. We can lead our nation and world in agriculture, or we can follow behind. I believe in the future of agriculture, and I believe strongly that we should lead that future. Thank you. God bless you all.